Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm the club's president and a national correspondent for Media General newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. Thank you. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching us on C-SPAN or listening to us on National Public Radio or the Internet Global Network, Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our guests of some upcoming speakers. As taxpayers are scrambling to get their taxes done, Margaret Richardson, Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, will address us on address the club on filing day, April 15th, that Friday. You got to be here to see this one. On Tuesday, April 19th, Senator Max Baucus, Democrat of Montana and Chairman of the International Trade Subcommittee, will talk about building a new relationship with China. And on Monday, April 25th, Ansan Chan, Chief Secretary of Hong Kong, the first woman and first Chinese to hold so high a position in the Hong Kong government, will discuss business opportunities in Hong Kong and in China after 1997. And she might even mention the most favored nation status. Transcripts, audio, and videotapes of this luncheon are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, and judging from all that have come up so far, I'm sure that you will, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them up, and I will ask as many as time allows. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. Please withhold your applause until all the names are read. From your right, Carol Byrne of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Masamichi Fujitsuka, Kyoto News Service. Michael Mainwaring, freelance journalist and member of the Board of Governors of the National Press Club. Steve Toma of the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Sonia Hilgren, Washington editor of the Farm Journal, chairwoman of the Board of Governors of the National Press Club, and who tells me that despite her Swedish name, she is actually 5/8 Norwegian, and therefore the only Norwegian on the Board of Governors, which qualifies her to be at the head table. And that her mother in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, was the original Garrison Keillor fan. Doug Turner of the Washington Bureau of the Buffalo News. Eleanor Clift of Newsweek Magazine. Skipping over our speaker for a moment, we have Christy Wise, freelance journalist and chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Doris Margolis, president of Editorial Associates and member of the Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. And we have Bjorn Hansen of Norwegian Broadcasting. Pat McGrath of Fox Television. Jack Cushman of the New York Times. Robert Daugherty of Reuters News Service. And finally, a special guest, Harold Starr Jr., foreign correspondent for the Lake Wobegon Herald Star. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, Melanie Abdow-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Now, today we are honored to have Garrison Keillor, creator of public radio's Prairie Home Companion and one of the premier storytellers in America today. I've been a fan of Mr. Keillor for years, not quite as long as Sonia's mother, perhaps, but a long time. The problem was that his show would come on the radio while I was driving somewhere, and I'd want to keep listening to it even after I had arrived. I would slow down, drive around the block a couple of times, then just park and listen. But in my neighborhood in Arlington, if you spend a lot of time sitting in a parked car, people get suspicious. Oh, look, they'll say, it's another CIA agent waiting for a payoff. So I solved that problem by buying tapes of Mr. Keillor's performances, and now I can drive for hours on long trips with the kids in the backseat yelling, Play the baseball song, Daddy. Play the front porch song. After a few years of listening, you feel like you know Lake Wobegon and the people who live there. Take the three generations of the Crips box, Florian and Myrtle, who are getting on in years, but they still enjoy fighting with each other. Florian once left Myrtle at a truck stop on the interstate heading for St. Cloud, and their son Carl, who sometimes wishes he wasn't quite so handy, because people are always calling him to have a look at something. And Carl's daughter, Carla, the beautiful homecoming queen, who could only be worshipped from afar by an unnamed, shy, gangling youth. It's that shy, gangling youth, of course, who created this little universe where you can get a cup of coffee from Darlene at the Chatterbox Cafe, or stop by the sidetrack for a beer and a bump with a Norwegian bachelor farmer. A native of Anoka, Minnesota, and a graduate of the University of Minnesota, Mr. Keeler launched a Prairie Home Companion on Minnesota Public Radio in 1974. 13 years later, he closed it and moved to New York City to begin a new show called Garrison Keeler's American Radio Company. But the name didn't stick, and he returned to his roots and brought back a Prairie Home Companion. Now Mr. Keeler has come to the press club to announce he is not running for president in 1996. We in Washington know what that really means. The woods of New Hampshire are filled with politicians, mostly Republicans, who claim they are not running for president. So what do we know of Mr. Keeler's politics? Not much. We know he's a liberal, but then he's from Minnesota, so what do you expect? But I want to leave it to Mr. Keeler to explain his politics and why he has seen fit to come to Washington to announce his non-candidacy. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm press club welcome for Mr. Garrison Keeler.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and so good to be able to get all of these Norwegians sitting up at the head table here. Ordinarily, Norwegian people would naturally take a seat towards the rear of the room, and it's good to get them up here in the bright light. I want to begin by sending congratulations and love and best wishes to a fellow Minnesotan, Justice Harry A. Blackmun, after his announcement yesterday that he's stepping down from the Supreme Court, and to thank him for his years of service to our country. I would love to be 85 years old someday, if I could be 85 in the way that Mr. Justice Blackmun is 85, and we will miss him. I'd like to thank you for inviting me today. Ordinarily, the National Press Club invites newsmakers to speak, men and women who, on account of the awesome power they wield, cannot speak in simple declarative sentences for fear that it will unsettle the bond market. And then, once in a while, the press club invites people like myself, a humble journalist like you, who has dedicated himself to telling the truth to the American people without fear or favor, no matter the personal cost. Including the terrible truth that the press tries to keep from the American people, which is that the country is actually going along pretty well. There is pain and danger and misery in America, and yet people still do get up in the morning and go to work, even in New York. They do this. It's the role of the press to scare us with stories about bears, and we enjoy this. We know that the roaring we hear outside the tent is not from bears, that it is from respected journalists crouched in the grass and hollering into culverts. And so we get up in the morning and we go to work. America gets along pretty well. I came up with this when I was in London for a couple of weeks in March, and I was explaining America to the British people, as I do, and that thought just sprang to my mind. America gets along pretty well. You can learn a lot about America by explaining it to other people. Now, before I go any farther in my speech, and I did come here to talk about 1996 and my plans, I just want to say that the statement that I gave to U.S. Customs at Newark Airport when I returned to this country is a statement that I still stand by. And that the total value of goods brought into this country by me at that time was $800, on which I paid a duty of $40, which is 10% of the amount over $400. It's true that I estimated the value of those items on the plane as it was making its final descent. And once I had claimed my baggage, I did not open it and check price tags and try to make an absolutely accurate appraisal. And perhaps in retrospect, I should have done that. Though I would say in my own defense that most of these items were gifts for friends and colleagues, and so the price tags had been removed. Nevertheless, I would be the first person here to say that that $800 was an estimate. It was my best estimate. But if the estimate should turn out to be low, I will pay the additional duty that would be required of me. Thank you very much. As for the gifts, and I'm sure you're curious about them, it is true that one of the gifts went to a friend of mine who is a public employee at a state mental hospital in Minnesota. And if that appears to be an inappropriate gift, I regret it. But in my own mind, I was not looking for personal favors. I have not patronized that hospital, to the best of my knowledge, at any time in the past 20 years. Now, I was not going to come down here and talk about Whitewater. But then I thought that if I did not talk about Whitewater, that you would assume that I know something about it. So, the only way for me to prove that I don't know anything about it is to talk about it at great length. And I'm willing to do that. It's been a quiet week in Whitewater. This morning's New York Times was devoid of any news. It's hard to find the one item in the Washington Post. But there is surely more to come on this, because an audience is still waiting to hear. With any shaggy dog story like this, whose point is its pointlessness, people become fascinated by the fact that they are still standing and listening to the story, though they don't know what it means. It's a long, winding, circumstantial joke, a shaggy dog story, that the teller keeps complicating by tossing in new, unrelated elements. Characters keep coming in, and sudden, inexplicable events that one assumes must be related in some way, and the storyteller's voice then becomes hushed. And we all lean forward, and now there are men with watermelons on their heads in this story, and there's buried treasure, and there's a naked lady on a horse, and there's a dog with very long hair whose name is Fred, and the dog's hair gets longer and longer, and the audience now realizes there is not going to be a punchline at all. And that the joke is that the teller has kept them hooked on an utterly inconsequential story. And then the shaggy dog speaks, and the dog says, "Woof." And that's the end. The difference with Whitewater is that it is not going to end. And you are going to be writing about this for much longer than you really want to. The Whitewater story has run for months on the power of suggestion, things we don't know that may be true, and if they were true, then other things might be true as well. And it's now a story about itself and whether the press should be devoting so much time to this, and what does this say about politics, and would this story have gotten so big if it weren't that people distrusted the president anyway? And now this week the story dwindles a little bit as we are low on fresh facts. We just have scraps of stories about inconsistencies in statements, about things that nobody ever suggested were wrong to begin with. But the American people are still sitting on the bleachers under the tent, and we are waiting for the elephant to come out. And all we see are the guys selling cotton candy. These guys are you. This is a lousy way to run a scandal. In Britain, they know how scandals ought to be done. Scandals should be big, they should be sudden, they should be fascinating, they should, if possible, involve sex, they should be on the front page for 3 days, and then they should be gone. When an American goes to London, it's fun to open up the morning paper. You know there will be a prize in there for you. There will be a story about a woman and her lover accused of trying to kill her husband with a lawnmower. Yes. And there will be a story about a man who is on trial for assault, for biting a woman twice on the right buttock in a bar where he was celebrating his engagement to a woman who was not the woman he bet. You don't get news like this in America. We never seem to get down and bite people on the buttock. There are any number of stories about shootings in bar rooms, but you could read 10 of them and they wouldn't be nearly as interesting as this one buttock biting incident. The man was drunk, of course. He knelt down. He raised the woman's skirt, described in the story as short, and he bit through her pantyhose and left a mark and did it twice. I don't know how we came to think of British people as a tasteful people. Maybe because their grammar is so good. There was a story about a conservative member of parliament who was found naked and dead in his kitchen, an accidental death in the midst of a very unusual sexual act that you should never try except with adult supervision. This was a typical British political scandal. It entertained millions of people for a few days at absolutely no public expense. There were no hearings, there was no special prosecutor, there were no tapes, no computer disks to be gone through, subpoenaed, no mountains of financial records to sort through. Just the fact that a politician who had always stood for old-fashioned family values evidently had a rich fantasy life as well. It was all in the papers, in the better papers, in great detail for 2 days, and then it was over. A scandal is a revelation of the humanity of famous people. Famous and powerful people can be amazingly human. A man can be a United States senator, knowledgeable about foreign policy, tax law, and dozens of other things, and also be capable of lunging at a woman whom he barely knows and kissing her on the lips against her will, which is a pretty dumb thing to do. And he can do this again and again over the years, grabbing women, hugging them, saying dumb things to them. A dreadful experience for the women, and they're right to expose him, and it ought to be in the papers. But how much time should the U.S. Senate spend on this? How much attention does this deserve? How much should this man spend on legal counsel? $250,000? Should he spend $500,000? And wouldn't it be better to simply say that any senator or congressman who lunges at a woman and kisses her against her will or grabs her should pay her $50,000? Just let it go at that. Skip the hearings. Let it be in the paper for a couple of days. One more dumb thing done by somebody you didn't think would do it. Have him pay the money, and we all go on to something else. To hold Senator Packwood up as a pariah is not attractive or becoming. It only shows our self-righteousness, and we already know how self-righteous we are. Now, I didn't come to discuss scandal. I came to discuss 1996 and the tremendous pressure that I've been under to consider a run for the presidency. But you seem to be interested in scandal, so let me continue. During the time that I was in London buying, to the best of my knowledge, about $800 worth of merchandise, the British Defense Chief of Staff was on the front page of numerous newspapers. He'd been photographed in front of the Dorchester Hotel, kissing a former mistress of his named Lady Bienvenida Buck. He is 60 years old, and she is, according to her best estimate, 32. According to the story, she had been his mistress for a couple of years, though she was married to someone else, and he was married as well. And now she had received $250,000 from one of the tabloids to lure the man to this rendezvous and to kiss him in a place where the light was good, and also to turn over his love letters to her, which the newspapers also printed. And the next day, the chief of staff resigned, which is sort of a tradition in Britain. So the British newspaper reader got to see the literary style of a 60-year-old man who'd spent his life in the military, and he wrote a pretty good love letter. It made me wonder how many men on the Joint Chiefs of Staff would be capable of doing this. He wrote a letter that began, "My darling, my little one, my love, you have maturity beyond your years, yet the body of a young girl. Your face is serene, your eyes piercing, your mouth enchanting, your back elegant, your hands so graceful, your skin so very fair and satin to touch, your breasts so petite, your legs so gazelle-like, your smell so overpoweringly intoxicating. How I long to hold you in my arms and to envelop you in kisses." Now, this is the sort of scandal a person can enjoy. A distinguished public servant who becomes infatuated with a younger woman, who then betrays him for money, brings him down in disgrace, and who then says, through her publicity man, that she revealed this affair to the newspapers not for the $250,000, but so that she could, quote, put it behind her and get on with her life. That's a story. Scandal ought to have something operatic about it. And futures trading is nothing that's particularly operatic compared to your eyes piercing, your mouth enchanting, your smell so overpoweringly intoxicating. Puccini could have set that to music. One thing that I've never seen anyone say in print in Mr. Clinton's first year, and so I'd like to say it today, is this. I like this president, and I think most people in the country do. He is a soulful man, and he is remarkably cheerful and optimistic, and these are good qualities. He got himself elected without scaring people, and he enjoys his work. He likes politics, he likes being around his fellow Americans, and he loves to talk. It's amazing to have a president who can face any audience, large or small, without a script and speak in sentences, sometimes gracefully. About any subject whatsoever. In my lifetime, presidents always have been pretty well guarded and managed, and you seldom saw them without a teleprompter or without notes in their hand, but here's one who can walk out and talk. A good thing in a democracy. This year, he has succeeded in moving so many wrenching public issues into the political arena, and he has done this with remarkable good humor. He's faced even this long, dreary story of Whitewater with about as much good humor as a person possibly could. A democracy like ours needs a certain good humor to keep bumping along. Government, as a profession, tends to attract people who have a lot of time to kill. And the proceedings of government tend to be long and verbose, and a democracy, of course, always welcomes the people's complaints, and the people who do come and complain exaggerate their complaints in hopes of getting action. So there's a lot of grimness around in a democracy. And without some good humor, government would not be able to come to work in the morning. A democracy is threatened by people's lack of faith in it. And when people lose faith in it because they would rather believe in conspiracies of powerful people manipulating the levers to thwart the will of the people, whether it be Wall Street or communist infiltrators or liberal intellectuals or Arkansas vacation home speculators, then democracy suffers from it. Whereas the British relish a scandal in which the private life of the great is suddenly revealed in a burst of light, we prefer scandals about shadowy characters who are in cahoots with each other and flushed out finally through inspired detective work. But the truth is that ours is a pretty open and democratic society. The press was after this president for weeks to answer questions. And when the president stood up to answer questions, he got questions like, who do you feel is responsible for this Whitewater story getting as big as it's gotten? A dumb question. The person who tells a shaggy dog story is responsible for that story. We're still waiting for the elephant to come out of the tent. The New York Times says there's an elephant in there. The Republicans say there is one. The Wall Street Journal hasn't come out yet. A White House aide calling up somebody in the Treasury Department to ask and complain about a Republican being hired to look into the savings and loan out in Arkansas, that's not an elephant. I'm still waiting to see the elephant. The president says he could do without the elephant and he'd like the country to move on to something else, but I'd like to see the elephant. And if the elephant doesn't come out pretty soon, I'd like to know why. When scandal breaks and we get to see the humanity of the great and the powerful revealed, naked and dumb in front of us, there's always a cry for new rules or at least some new awareness that will prevent this from ever happening again. We should be careful, though, not to make the world so fine and good that you and I can't enjoy living in it. A world in which there is no sexual harassment at all is a world in which there will not be any flirtation. A world without thieves at all will not have entrepreneurs. A government in which there are no friendly connections or favors between politicians and powerful people would be the first in the history of mankind. And a world without fiction, my friends, would be unbearable for all of us. Thank you.
You will notice he did not categorically deny he was running in 1996. The first question is, what are they saying about Bill Clinton at the Chatterbox Cafe? Do they agree with you there? And do the people, does what they say at the Chatterbox Cafe differ at all from what they're saying at this sidetrack?
Well, the people at the Chatterbox Cafe are by and large Scandinavian people. You have to keep that in mind. And so their view of other people, especially people far away whom they do not know, such as the president, tends to be dark. Scandinavians take a dark view of human nature so that they will not ever be surprised by anything that happens. I would not care to trust my fate to the opinion of the people whom I find in the Chatterbox Cafe. And I don't trust the president's fate to them either. You'd have to ask them what they think.
This questioner says, since you prefer sex scandals, please give us your views on the stories quoting Arkansas state troopers about Mr. Clinton's affairs.
I saw a photograph of those state troopers in the newspaper. They were both photographed in black and white, and I think I rest my case on the on the photograph.
There is a strong movement to relocate the nation's capital to Lake Wobegon. Are there any thoughts on how that would affect the country's future?
Well, they're not aware of this strong movement at home, and they'll be seriously alarmed. One thing it would mean if you moved the capital of our country to central Minnesota is that for long periods of the year, when you had come to Washington, Minnesota, you would not be able to leave Washington, Minnesota. And so Congress would not be able to get off for weekends to to meet with constituents and to go out and tell the truth to the American people. Members of Congress would be pretty much stuck there in Washington, Minnesota, looking at each other over the weekend. I'm not sure if this would be good or bad. Minnesota is a state, though, with a serious theology, and I think that would be good in government. We are a state where three or four times in the course of a year, nature makes a serious attempt to kill us. So I think we're less sanguine than people in Congress often seem to be, who seem to believe that someday somebody's going to figure this out.
You mentioned the theology in Minnesota, and you have the Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility on one side of the street and the Lake Wobegon Lutheran Church on the other side of the street. How do these people get along? Is there a chance this could break down like Yugoslavia at any time?
No, I don't think so. We're not that well armed, for one thing. And the people who do bear arms in Lake Wobegon are not always in condition to operate them. We get along pretty well in Lake Wobegon, I think, on the basis of nearly complete misunderstanding of each other. We look at people whose beliefs are basically different from ours. We look on them as being really beyond the pale. And so we don't bother to try to win them over to our side. That's really where the big problems come in human relations, I think, is when we believe there's a chance for the other person to see the light. That's where the problems come in. But when you believe that the other person is dumber than dirt and hopelessly ignorant and not worth wasting your breath on, you get along with them pretty well.
Have the late Wobegon Whippets played their first game? And if so, who threw out the first ball?
This is just early April, and the Lake Wobegon Whippets don't even start thinking about training or getting in shape for about another 6 weeks. Their first game will be on the Memorial Day weekend. I don't know why they choose this weekend when we commemorate our valiant dead to begin their season, but there's a long time yet. There are guys in the sidetrack tap who they've got a long time to get into shape.
Can you please give a detailed description of the statue of the unknown Norwegian?
Well, the statue of the unknown Norwegian was constructed by the Sons of Canute Fraternal Lodge back in the about 100 years, 1870s, I believe, to commemorate the emigrants. The statue is called the Statue of the Unknown Norwegian because the man who modeled for the statue moved on west before anybody got his name. He was sculpted in marble in a heroic pose. He's pointing off to the west, and he is saying something heroic that I believe probably if they hadn't spent all the money on that sculpture, they would have put an inscription on the base, but they couldn't afford the base, so we don't know what he's saying exactly. He looks as if, most of the year, he looks as if he is saying, Onward toward yon setting sun, ye who have struggled so long for the dream, tire not nor weary, but pursue ever onward yon guiding star. However, there is no base for this statue, so he stands about the same height as the rest of us. So up close, he doesn't look that heroic. When the Christmas tree is put up in the square there in front of him, he looks as if he's saying, "That's leaning a little bit to the left." You want to bring it back this way, just a little. We're fond of him. We grew up with him, and so we became so familiar with him that we didn't realize he exists. It's only when you move away from Lake Wobegon and stay away as long as I have that you're able to give this detailed description. A person who was still living in Lake Wobegon couldn't tell you anything about the statue of the unknown Norwegian because they see it every day, 2-3 times a day. They're hardly aware that it's there. They might even be surprised to know it's in their midst. This is why writers leave home, is so that you can have the necessity of remembering. Was that a complete sentence? I think that was it.
Well, getting to leaving home then, how did you like living in New York, and how would you compare it to living in Anoka?
Well, living in New York is something that that a few ambitious people in Anoka dream of when they're 13 or 14 years old. I wanted something to happen to me when I was 13 or 14. I wanted the car to come along and pick me up and take me off where I imagined life was being lived with fervor and passion by people who were not afraid to look foolish. New York is that sort of a place. From the time I first saw it, when my father took me out there as a little boy, I was fascinated by it. Other people I grew up with prefer quiet and stately places, the deserts and the ocean. They became sailors, or they wanted to move to remote rural areas. I never did. I like to live in a place where I'm safe, but when I'm tired of being safe, I can get to dangerous places in a hurry and get down on the street and hear people yelling at each other and people exposing their lives all within just a few blocks. And I live in a good neighborhood. There are other places where it's even more dramatic than that. I'm very fond of New York. Of course, I moved there as a privileged person. I should say that, being a truthful journalist. And I had plenty of money when I moved there, and that's different. And I was in my late 40s, and I was a little bit too old to get into the sorts of trouble that I would have been anxious to get into when I was 14. But still, I enjoy it. There are mornings in New York, I think of October, when the city is golden and suffused with light, when you wake up in the morning and shower and shave and eat your bagel and leave the house and you walk down to the subway and you head down the stairs and your steps quicken as you head down. And about once or twice a year, you come onto that subway platform just as the train is pulling up and the doors are opening. And everything that you've done in your life up to that point seems exactly right and to have taken exactly the right amount of time for you to catch that train. It's for moments like that that a romantic person like myself lives. And I'm well able to ignore all the rest of it.
This just in from the Reverend Daphne over here, who I think is writing a book about the gospel, according to Garrison Keillor. How important is that Minnesota theology or other regional theological variants to the way America is doing pretty well?
What was the question? How important is that Minnesota theology to the way America is going pretty well? Oh, I don't think so important. I know that other people around the country look on Minnesota as being crucial to the life of this country and being a source of wisdom. But we in Minnesota, we don't feel that way at all. We modestly take our place up there at the top and middle of America, defending the border against Canada, and we just take it as it comes. No, I just can't assign too much importance to Minnesota or Minnesotans. Not here in front of this audience.
This questioner wants to know, what is the secret of the culinary success of the Café Boeuf?
Well, the secret of cooking at the Café Boeuf is the secret of my secret as a cook and a lot of other people. First of all, is cooking slow so that you have a chance to change direction. And the other secret is cooking things that are really much simpler than the uninitiated realize. There are some things, puff pastry and souffles and so on, that I just won't touch because it's really hazardous to get into it. It'd be like singing opera. You really are exposing yourself to risk. But there are a lot of other dishes that the cook likes to do in private because they're really slick and simple. Do I have time to share these recipes? No.
Is there such a thing as a Minnesota accent?
Yes, there is. I lost it because I wanted to, from the time I got into radio, when I was 18, I wanted my listeners in Minnesota to think that I was from someplace else. I thought they would give me more credence if they believed that. I wanted them to believe, for a long time, I wanted them to believe that if I was not actually from the United Kingdom, that perhaps I was descended from people who were. My descendants, however, left England in the latter part of the 18th century, so it was a long time. Yes, there is a Minnesota accent. I could do it for you, but I would embarrass the Minnesotans who are sitting up here at the head table.
What would you do if you were editor of The New Yorker, assuming you would want the job?
Who sent this question up? Is it?
There's also a P.S. If you're not busy April 23rd and happen to be in Toledo, why not come to my wedding? And there's no name assigned to this.
Is Mr. Newhouse here in the ground? I don't want to consider a hypothetical job offer. It just it isn't good. If they want me to come and edit The New Yorker, I'm ready. And I'll be getting on a plane anyway this afternoon, so I can be up there towards the end of the day. But I don't want to show my hand too early.
What do you think of Hillary Clinton and her expanded role as First Lady?
Well, her expanded role seems to have contracted very suddenly here in the last month or two. and she's been rather secretive. I think an awful lot of her, and I wish her the very best. I was sorry to see her interview in People magazine the other day, in which I had a feeling that the First Lady succumbed to a kind of self-pity that's a real hazard, I think, for people in public life. She'll regret that. She'll regret that. She's really very lucky, and I hope that she feels lucky again soon. She should, because she is lucky. She's bright and full of idealism and enthusiasm, and she's married to a soulful guy.
A lot of people want to know things about the show, of course, like how did you happen to create the Prairie Home Companion, and tell us about Tom Keith, and does he really know how to speak French? And every program is so perfect. How long do you and your cast rehearse?
That's a lot of questions, but I'm going to answer each of them in tremendous detail, and I'm not going to withhold a single salient fact from you here if we have to stay the afternoon. I created Prairie Home Companion as a way to avoid work. is the plain truth. I had been working for Minnesota Public Radio and doing a show that began at 6 o'clock in the morning, and it went until noon. And as part of this, I had to do the news. I had to do all manner of things. And I worked out this other deal where I did one show on Saturdays, and it was only an hour and a half to start. Now I'm doing 2 hours, so I'm getting half an hour overtime. And it was on once a week, and they paid me more money to do this. This is a great deal, and I recommend this to you. How and when did I meet Tom Keith? He was a guy who was working in radio with me when we got up early in the morning, and did the news and read the sports scores and advertised lost dogs and gave out recipes for oatmeal cookies. And then after I got this good deal, a part-time job that paid really well, I, of course, got him a place on my show where he plays a number of roles. He does the voices of all our animals, including cats and dogs, and elk, a very difficult sound effect, which I taught him myself. Elk make a sound that is something like this. I taught him that, and that is also the sound made by moose and by wapiti. And elands, I believe, make a similar sound. Does he really know how to speak French? He only knows how to speak French to people who don't speak French. And to us, he speaks great French, really, really better than the original. How long does the cast of the show rehearse? We rehearse on Friday night. Today is Thursday. I go back up to New York. I start writing tonight, and I write tomorrow morning, and we rehearse it on Friday evening, and then we do the show on Saturday. That is not a bad deal. That is a 2.5 day a week job. And that's the secret of the good life, ladies and gentlemen, is a short work week.
Well, we're almost out of time. Just a reminder that audio and video and transcripts can be had by calling 1-800-500-9911. But first, I'd like to present you with a National Press Club mug, which now you've been here three times, so you've got three of them. We made this one blue, so you would not be a match set. There you go. It works. And, of course, a certificate of appreciation for appearing here. Nice, nice. Well, let's see. There are a lot of good last questions here. There's one they want me to ask about the red socks you're wearing, but I don't know. Those are the wonderful red socks. So maybe I could ask you about guys' shoes. Are you wearing guys' shoes? But why didn't Disney America, or should Disney America, instead of coming to Virginia, should they not move to Lake Wobegon? And is not that the real America?
We'd much rather they stayed here, and I believe that the American people would want Disney America to be in a convenient place, where having stopped in Washington to see the Smithsonian and be photographed on the steps of the Capitol with their congressman or congresswoman, they could then go off and take gondola rides through Civil War scenes and see animated figures of American presidents speaking. I think it's just they go together. To put it in Lake Wobegon or Minnesota would be an inconvenience to the American people, and I am opposed to anything that would be an inconvenience for the American people.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNet Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier, to the Global Village.